If they were here at all, it means they're heading west. You want to lead the way? Tubbs nodded again. He was in the Hummer and he rolled his window open.
If you can keep up.
And he sped down the driveway, leaving Dex alone with his car and a bad feeling. 23. Cole. The rain became very heavy in a matter of seconds as Cole ran back through the door thoroughly soaked. The two of them exchanged raised eyebrows at the suddenness of the downpour, a kind of awkward moment of human interaction that he'd missed.
"Suddenly got colder,"
Lena said as she hugged her arms and rubbed some warmth into herself. She went to tend the fire as Cole reached for one of the coats they had been using as bedding for her. As more sticks were added to the fire to combat the sudden chill brought by the cold winds and the heavy rain, a hint of a sound tickled Cole's consciousness.
"So," Lena said, "I was thinking—"
"Shh," Cole hissed at her, his head cocked to one side and his mouth open.
"What is it? Shh,"
he said again, more fervently this time. There, he heard it again. Or did he? It was like hearing a remembered sound in his mind. Not sure if it was a real sound or just an echo of memory. He heard it again. This time his body only allowed for a second of panic before he reacted. Cole held a finger to his lips, helped her into the coat, held up the straps as she zipped up the waterproof jacket before slipping her hands into the straps. He put on a similar jacket and hefted his own pack, yanking on the straps to tighten it as he scuffed ash onto the flames to try and kill their fire. Her wide eyes told him she needed to know what had spooked him so much, and he leaned in close to her ear to whisper a single word to chill her spine.
"Seekers."
Hiding was out of the question, seeing how obvious it was that people had been living there with the evidence on show. He considered the prospect of suspending them inside the dark shaft of the well until the threat had passed, but his fear of that plan going wrong pushed it away. Dying a cold, terrified, agonizing death in the icy water so far below the surface was not a prospect he relished. There was nowhere else they could hide, which left one option. Run. SW-18. SW-18 watched the three drone feeds simultaneously. Running all three inputs at once slowed down the processing speed significantly, but it was quicker to scan a larger area and focus its full attention when something of note was flagged. Footprints flagged on one drone, not as an alert, but simply a record of human presence to be cataloged and checked by the analytics program when the seeker was next downloaded. SW-18 saw it and immediately redeployed the two drones to that location. What the seekers didn't know, because they had no consciousness and no ability to interpret data with anything resembling choice, was that the rain would have washed away any substantial tracks in the last 12 hours, making that discovery very significant. SW-18 started off at a lumbering trot in the direction of the prints, using half of its functional running memory to monitor the drones and the other half to travel safely in the storm, which meant moving slower than it wanted to. The side of the hill it ascended was slippery and threatened to topple it with each additional drop of rain. About halfway up, it was forced to discard active control of the drones in order to divert its full memory capacity to negotiating the slick climb. Nearing the top, a gunshot blasted the air, sounding like the storm had graduated to thunder and lightning. SW-18 pushed for the crest as another noise forced the memory banks to be sifted through for the correlating entry.
"We have to go," Cole said, grabbing her arm a little tighter than he needed to.
"Can't we hide?" she asked. "Won't it leave if it can't find us?"
"It's obvious we're here,"
he told her with another tug on her thin elbow, forcing her off balance.
"There's nowhere we can—"
Barking from outside made him stop and stare through the grimy windows. In the low light, he could make out a hovering silver shape near the storeroom door
and saw the exposed canine teeth of the coyote standing its ground against the drone. Knowing he only had seconds before it shot at the animal, he ripped open the door and advanced on the seeker with the butt of the shotgun pulled tight into his shoulder. Boom! Shuk-shik! The drone didn't disintegrate, but it did spin wildly out of the air and bounce off the stone wall before hitting the wet dirt. Cole hadn't stopped moving as he had fired and reloaded, reaching the seeker as it tried with futility to return to the air. Cole raised a boot heel and stamped on the damaged machine, finding it oddly hollow and unsubstantial. He glanced over his shoulder to see if Lena was with him, relieved to find that she was. He ran for the rear slope off their hilltop bastion as the coyote behind them erupted into a barking frenzy. It took SW-18 only a few more seconds to crest the rise and aim automatically for the simplest path inside the low walls where the noises had come from. It arrived at the same time as the other two seekers, and as another gunshot was muted slightly by the falling rain and the oppressively heavy air. It slipped through a gap in the stones instead of risking jumping across the wall, unable to see what was on the other side. It was already diverting memory power to the other two drones to take over wireless control of them when an unexpected noise accompanied the sensation of flying. SW-18 realized it had fallen for an old hunter's trap. The coyote started to bark at an insanely high pitch, full of rage and hate for what had arrived at the edge of the slope, and as Cole saw what was happening, he almost fell with the shock of seeing the tracker. The dull metal and battered bodywork couldn't disguise what had come for them. He believed their time was truly up, as he had never been this close to one of the deadly robots before. As far as he knew, nobody had. Nobody alive, anyway. When he thought it was all finished, the tracker shot skyward on a slingshot as its head was half pulled from its body by the wire of the snare, snapping tight around it and jerking it off the ground. The weight of it made the struggle worse, banging it into the metal pole hard enough to bounce away and spin around crazily. Cole didn't hesitate, lining up his shotgun again and firing as he advanced on it. He had to kill it, or they were both dead. He fired all seven of his remaining shots, racking the slide again and clicking the trigger on an empty chamber as Lena appeared beside him and added her own booming report to the show. The shrill whine of a drone made both of them scrabble for a reload as another seeker came through the rain directly at them. Cole fumbled the shotgun round in his hand, dropping it to the mud by accident, and desperately tried to wipe it clean on his pants leg. Lena managed to reload first, and her shot rang out too close behind his ear, making him flinch away. The world went quiet for him, save for a high-pitched shriek permeating his senses and whiting out any thoughts he had. He was on his knees, his right hand sinking into the sludge. Sound returned with the small thud of the damaged drone slamming into the ground beside him and flailing its small appendages to try and move upright and into the air. He brought down the butt of the empty gun to crunch the frail body once before grabbing Lena's hand. "Run," he said, unsure how loud he spoke as his hearing wasn't fully restored. She pulled her hand from his and ran with him, hardly able to believe they'd survived the attack. 24. Alec. They walked for another mile or so before Monet stopped them.
"We wait for nighttime."
That ended up being 2 hours, but with the cloud cover, darkness came sooner rather than later, and eventually Monet was leading Alec toward the gargantuan warehouse. It wasn't long before he saw the great Lake Michigan beyond the huge complex. He'd never seen such a sight.
"Come on, we don't have time to stand and gawk. The trucks leave at dawn, and we have to be on the right one," Monet said, trudging forward.
The entire facility was fenced, but once again, it wasn't much more than a 4-foot wooden structure that was easy enough to scale and climb over. A seeker hovered overhead, but they were hidden beneath the tree canopy, so it kept moving. Alec's heart beat so loudly he worried a drone would hear it and come for them. None did.
"Are they always so easy to evade?" Alec asked. "They're not watching for people coming in. Rarely happens. They're only worried about people leaving, and I use the word worried loosely," On the off chance someone does escape, they have trackers and hunters to clean up, Monet said.
How often do roamers escape? He asked. Her eyes were steeled as she looked at him without any hint of kidding.
Not often. As close to none as you can imagine.
This sent a shiver up his spine, and he fiddled with his pack, trying to take his mind off a potential capture. What were they doing? They were heading into one of the region's largest warehouses. He'd even seen the massive Overseer space vessel on the ground near the building. The place was likely to be teeming with them. Alec wondered how many of the aliens a ship like that could hold. It had to be hundreds, maybe thousands. He'd only ever seen a few at a time. How many were there on Earth? How many ships like this did they have? He wished he had answers and hoped Monet could fill him in later. But she didn't even know where her own team's base was located, so that didn't bode well for them. There were so many unknowns. But the one thing he was fairly certain about was that they were going to be caught, or worse, sneaking into the enemy's warehouse. Alec tried finding his bearings. They were within the basic fenced area of the warehouse, and the ship was half a mile away. He saw movement between it and the gigantic facility. Was it the Overseers walking there? Was he that close to so many of them? His skin crawled as he recalled the scent of the alien's skin as it neared him when Beth was shot. It had stared at him with dead yellow eyes. He would have been less disturbed if the gaze held malice instead of indifference. Big trucks entered from the highway on the other side of the facility. Monet had called them semis. Their headlights shone in the dusk. His eyes followed them to the loading bays of the building. There had to be 20 or 30 of them parked.
That's a lot of trucks, he said. Even Monet looked surprised.
You're not kidding.
Have you been here before?
Never.
His heart sank.
How are we going to know what truck to sneak onto? Alec asked.
Leave that to me,
she said, hefting her pack onto her shoulders. She tugged his sleeve and he followed her as she ran along the tree line. The sun had set by the time Monet waved them away from the trees, and he duplicated her hunched jog. Alec heard the whine of a seeker but kept moving, aware the seeker couldn't read their IDs with the bracelet blockers over their wrists. The drones could easily target them as fugitives if they came into view. What had Monet called them? Freeborns? Monet stopped behind one of a series of smaller buildings outside the giant warehouse.
These are trailers. They use them for meetings when they do construction work and store outdoor equipment in them. Since I don't see any construction going on, I think they're likely empty. Let's find out.
Monet stood with her back against the side of the trailer, and Alec followed her around to a door.
Locked.
Monet pulled a tool from her pack, and she jammed it into the metal frame around the plastic door and pushed. It snapped open, and she glanced around before shoving Alec inside. Monet activated a dim flashlight, setting it on the floor to give them barely enough light to obtain a visual on the room.
Look for a tablet or a computer, she said,
and Alec got to work sifting through the trailer's five desks. There were papers strewn about and coffee cups above dark rings on folders. There really was a whole world out there Alec didn't know about. He pictured his nemesis, Simon, standing in a room like this one, drinking coffee and laughing about the half-chit he gave one of the workers just because he could. Something reflected a shred of light under a piece of paper, and he slid the sheet to the side.
Is this what you're after?
He asked, and Monet rushed to him.
And Bingo was his name-o.
The tablet was dark, and she flipped it around in her hand until she found the power key, and with a press the screen lit up. Alec had seen the site supervisors with similar tools, but he didn't know what purpose they served.
What's it going to do?
I'm hoping this has the roots.
She was moving through the screen so fast it made Alec dizzy. Clearly she had experience with the tablets.
There we go. This hasn't been updated for a while, but it looks like... Wait, this might be even better.
What? He peered over her shoulder, the letters and numbers on the screen making little sense to him.
There's a truck heading for Omaha, but it continues on to Denver. If we can hop on board there, we can get to McCook in no time.
Monet was grinning from ear to ear, and Alec wasn't sure which was worse, hiding out in a semi-trailer waiting to be caught, or running outside for countless miles to McCook.
How far is Denver from McCook? He asked. We won't be going to Denver, she said with a glimmer of trouble in her eyes.
He was starting to read her expressions, and this one spoke volumes of trouble.
For once, can you stop being so vague and just fill me in? He said too loudly.
Growing a backbone. I like that.
She gave him a light punch in the arm.
Fine. I have something I can plant on the wheel well. When we're near McCook, I blow a tire. They stop the truck, we jump out. No harm, no foul.
He rolled his eyes at her.
Why does it always sound so easy coming from your mouth?
Because I have something you don't.
What's that?
Confidence. If this schedule is still the same, the truck bound for Denver leaves in 8 hours. We have to make sure we're on it. That means we wait until the guards are almost done with their shift. At 4 a.m., the night guards switch off with the morning crew. The night crew people are groggy, sometimes a little drunk, and often bored. It's the best time to make the trip to the loading bay. We head for Bay 12.
How do you know so much? Alec asked.
How do you think? I used to be a guard. In another lifetime.
Monet's eyes unfocused.
Looks like we have some time. Maybe you can tell me about it?
Alec prodded. She crossed the cramped space to the exit and slid the twisted lock closed before settling down to the ground, her back on the door. She held her gun in her hand, but settled it to her lap.
They recruited me when I was about your age, she started.
The Reclaimers? He asked. She nodded.
I'd managed to befriend a supervisor at the kids' camp. They falsified my documents to keep me from getting into the breeding facilities. I couldn't do it. It all seemed so wrong to me. I remembered what the world was like before. I got stuck working the fields in Kentucky, and it wasn't so bad. Hard work, but I got sick, pneumonia, and I almost died. Someone had to stick their neck out to get me medication and assistance. They ended up moving me to a manufacturing plant like yours, only we were doing repair work on their hover cars and ships. I never had the pleasure of entering one, but I worked plenty on the cars.
What are they like?
Alec asked. He leaned toward her, enthralled by her story. His was so boring, so lame in comparison.
The hover cars? Loud, inefficient, but they fly the bastards around, so convenient, I suppose. Where was I?
She asked, looking at the far wall in the dark.
Manufacturing plant. Right. That's where I met Crash and Jackfish. Crash was part of the Reclaimers. Showed up one day with the kid and targeted me. I still don't know why.
Alec did.
Probably because you're energetic, strong, opinionated, and make good company, he said, glad of the darkness.
He didn't know what had come over him.
I bet you say that to all the ladies, she laughed. They told me about the Reclaimers after a couple months, and I bought in, big time. In my experience, humans were shit at times, but I'd had enough of them looking out for me in my short life that I knew it was worth risking my own existence to make a difference, and here we are.
Her head leaned on the door behind her.
That's great. We need people like you to help. I can't believe there's even anyone out there fighting the occupation, Alec mented.
He'd lived his entire life up to this point being forced to accept status quo. And a fire burned deep in his belly at the thought of changing that. This was his moment, his recruitment, and he was all in.
I'm sorry about Jackfish, he said, remembering the dead man was her friend. And Crash? I have every expectation that Crash will be alive and that we'll see him again.
Her voice was quiet, and Alec wasn't sure if it held the same conviction as before.
I bet he is, too. I only just met the guy, but he seemed like the strongest man I'd ever seen. If he's anything like you, he'll be fine,
Alec said. They stayed there talking for a while before taking the opportunity to sleep. Monet told him she had an alarm in her pack, and she set it for 3 a.m.
Alec was shaken awake right on cue, and he stretched, trying not to consider the immense danger they were about to walk into.
"Okay. The loading dock is right over there,"
Monet pointed toward the door and northwest of the trailers.
"We're making for trailer 12. They load the goods and shut the doors, without much preamble. We need to be on that trailer, hidden, and I have a quick stop to make before then."
"We'd better do this." Alec clutched his gun in his hand, but he hadn't practiced firing it. The door swung open and Monet took the lead. Alec felt the cool middle-of-the-night air against his sweating brow and started toward the edge of the massive warehouse. The ground began to shake, and Alec worried they had been seen. The same sound from earlier carried to his ears, and an immense light filled the entire area from his right.
"Keep moving, that's their ship activating," Monet said,
and he looked away from the bright source, trying to blink away the spots from his eyes. The alien vessel was firing up right as they were trying to run toward the loading dock. Alec knew it had to be a coincidence, but it was an unlikely one.
"This is good," Monet whispered. "Everyone will be distracted."
Monet led him to the first semi's parking spot. It held the number 1 on the truck, and he saw the same number on the closed bay door. Monet climbed under the trailer, rolling in the gravel to the other side, and he did his best effort to imitate her. Number 2. They had some ways to go. He was under the second trailer when he heard the footsteps crunching on the rocks nearby. The ground shook again, a constant hum and vibrations that jarred Alec's teeth and turned his brain to mush. His heart blasted against his chest when he heard a voice from the next trailer.
"I'm not working any later tonight. They can't just show up unannounced and then take off at 4 in the morning."
The woman's voice was loud.
"Keep it down. You don't want one of them to hear you, do you?"
a male asked in return.
"And then what? Do you actually think they even speak our language?" she asked.
"I don't know. Just keep it quiet until they leave. God, they give me the creeps."
More footsteps, and now the voices came from in front of the truck they were hiding under.
"Let's watch them take off, then I'll be able to sleep after my shift," the woman said.
"Give me a minute. Shoelace,"
he said, and the woman whistled as she walked away, gravel crunching loudly. Monet clasped a hand over Alec's mouth and rolled onto her belly.
"What the—"
the voice said, and his steps were coming closer. They weren't hiding very well under the trailer, and Alec knew this was it. He held his gun tightly. But Monet met his gaze and shook her head. He glanced down and saw a knife in her hand.
"Who's there? Is that you, Kelly?"
the man crouched beside Monet. 25. Cole. The rest of the night was spent in a rush of pain and exhaustion as they fled. The slope they ran down from the hilltop pointed roughly north, so they simply tried to put as much distance between themselves and the machines as they could. It was easy to get turned around in the dark, especially in the storm, and a few times they lost one another and were forced to call out. Neither of them spoke a word other than those few times. The fear of seeing a tracker and the stress of escaping it spurred them beyond their normal limits. Long before the dawn, they were forced to stop and rest. Cole recognized the danger in how Lena moved. He forced open the door of the nearest building, grunting loudly with the effort of pushing the sliding metal along seized tracks against years and years of rust. Managing to create a gap barely large enough for them to slip through, he took off his pack and pushed it ahead of him, fumbling in the top pouch for the small flashlight that needed to be wound up to emit a dull glow. Holding it in his left hand along with the foregrip of the shotgun, he investigated the single-story building, checking the corners and the other few rooms before settling on a small room without windows and returning to lead Lena inside. "Dry clothes," he told her as they had both shivered. After the stress and exertion of their escape, their bodies were now leaking out their heat through the wet material at a rate that would cause them serious issues soon.
He stripped off his own layers without shame, turning away from her as she was clearly more reserved, even in spite of the tiny amount of light the dying flashlight gave off to illuminate the small space. They pulled dry clothes out of their packs and put them on over wet, cold skin as they both shivered.
"We need a fire,"
he said, looking around for anything that would burn to accompany the bundle of dry kindling wrapped up in his kit. She nodded, her teeth chattering uncontrollably, making her unable to get any words out. Cole grabbed her hands and put them on her torso, rubbing them up and down by way of instruction before he left the room. He took the flashlight with him and heard a small yelp of fear as he left her in the dark. He found three old wooden chairs, all covered in a thick layer of grime and compacted dust, like many things, and began breaking them up before putting the broken pieces into a small metal trash can that had some dusty old paper at the bottom. He returned to find Lena still in the same position, rubbing her body with her hands robotically. He put down the trash can and set light to the small shards of dry wood that had been buried in the very center of his bag. The wood caught quickly, especially as he added a handful of the fluffy stuffing from one of the coats left behind at the last place. The broken wood went on and took a few minutes to catch properly, but soon the small orange flames began to radiate heat. Lena knelt beside it, sucking up the warmth as though she knew her life depended on it. Cole took out some of the dried meat from his pack and a bottle of water, holding it out to her insistently until she relented and took them. As they both chewed on the smoky meat, a sound in the outer room made them freeze. It was a wet sound. Cole could think of no other way to describe it, and he heard the distinct echo of footsteps. Not the sound of 2 feet falling one after the other, but of 4 legs moving together. He reached slowly for his shotgun, somehow thinking that fast movement would bring the thing chasing them down in their hiding place like a fury. He carefully pointed the barrel at the gap in the door where the smoke from their fire drifted away. The footsteps came towards them, forcing another small yelp from Lena, who reached with shaking hands for her own gun. The sound was closer, but there was something about the noise that made Cole twitch the barrel upwards away from the door and reach out a hand to stop Lena from pulling her trigger. In the flickering orange light of their small fire, her face, lips still shivering, registered confusion and fear, but he hoped his eyes returned a look of confidence and belief that she should trust him. He picked up a strip of dried meat and tossed it into the gap by the door to hear a sound he had hoped for. A rumbling growl ceased as a wet snout darted into the light just long enough to grab the meat and withdraw, already chewing and chomping on the scrap hungrily. Cole relaxed, glad that his senses had told him it wasn't the tracker that had followed them. He heard the claws click away from their hiding place, uneven as the coyote limped, probably exhausted after the fast journey through the heavy rain. Lena didn't seem so reassured and kept her wide eyes on the gap with her gun gripped in her hands tightly. He tried to soothe her, to tell her it wasn't a danger to them when he wasn't certain if he believed it fully himself. He trusted his instinct, like he'd learned to by growing up in the harsh world where detection because of an ignored feeling meant death. And his instinct told him to trust that the animal hadn't followed them to do them any harm.
"Rest for a while,"
he told her, as he shuffled to block the door with his body, knowing that she wouldn't relax if she thought the coyote could get to her. She nodded, put another piece of wood on the fire, and curled up next to it for warmth before giving in to mental and physical exhaustion. The rain stopped a couple of hours later, and as tired as Cole's body had been, his eyes refused to close. The stress and fear he'd felt when the tracker emerged onto their hilltop had seemed like a premonition of death to him, but now, miles away and taking faith from the knowledge that their injured companion had found them when the tracker could not, he began to feel like they'd escaped. But he knew that they couldn't stay there, not after a tracker had been destroyed. Cole thought about how Tom used to tell him stories about the aliens using drones to hunt humans. One of those tales told of how a group of men and women had lured a tracker towards them and crushed it with a rockfall trap. They were still celebrating when the hovercraft dropped from high in the sky to flood the air with an army of drones that captured all of them.
"How do you know if everyone was captured?"
he had asked at the time, his young age not dulling his keen intellect. He remembered Tom smiling and tapping the side of his nose in a gesture that he used when he didn't have an answer but wanted to appear like he did. When the rain stopped and the wind died down, he gently shook Lena awake, making sure that her hand wasn't on her gun when she'd fallen asleep. Holding a finger to his lips in the last light of their drying fire, he gestured that they needed to get moving again. Reluctantly, he rose, his body stiff and aching from the running and the short sleep on a hard floor. They put on their damp clothes, strapped on their packs, and set off, taking their bearings from the light gray glow in the sky to their right. Behind them, lurking somewhere in the shadows of the building, their unexpected companion slunk out to follow them.
SW18. At dawn, the quiet hilltop erupted into a maelstrom of noise and activity as the hovercraft settled in to land in the central square. Damp dust whipped all around, and a team of four trackers dropped from the belly of the small ship and spread out in different directions as the ramp extended from the rear and a pair of thin lower legs emerged as the overseer descended. SW-18's master came next, exposing the scaled skin stretched taut over the muscular thighs where the hands hung on long arms. As it hit the wet ground, it lifted one leg as though it had stepped in something unpleasant before raising a tablet device and tapping at it with a long claw. The almond-shaped yellow eyes looked up to take in the battered, mangled form of the last-generation tracker drone. A noise from further up the ramp, still mostly inside the hovercraft, made the alien on the ground growl and chirp a response.
"Didn't know we had any of the old ones left in the area,"
it said to its companion on the ground.
"I thought they'd all been recalled for an upgrade."
"As did I,"
said the other, slipping the tablet into a pouch on its leg and reaching up to pull the half-destroyed remains of the drone down on what appeared to be a rudimentary wire trap. It was cut free and dropped to the ground, gathering more wet dust in the holes torn in its body by what looked like old Earth weapons. The alien grimaced to itself, considering that these old weapons were still capable of tearing one of its own kind apart.
"Anything from the other drones?"
it asked its companion as it dragged the ruined unit up the ramp.
"Nothing,"
it said.
"Readings indicate a storm washed away signs, so finding the vermin that did this would be difficult and costly,"
it added pointedly.
"Let them run,"
the other one said.
"We're off this rotation soon anyway, and I'm in no hurry to be kept in this empty, dry hole any longer than I have to be. I miss the ocean."
"As do I,"
another voice shouted from the cockpit further inside the hovercraft.
"Dump the broken unit back at the plant, and let's be done with this place."
Lena. The days rolled together into a blur of walking and sleeping. She'd resisted at first, unused to anything but the home she had grown up in. She found the big bad world outside their valley was full of terrifying things, but after 4 or 5 days, it was simply no longer a struggle to fall asleep. While Lena was accustomed to people and talking, she found that the longer she spent with Cole, the more she realized he was having a difficult time caring for another person's well-being. She tried to make conversation as they walked, giving up when he started to make annoyed noises whenever she broke the silence.
She guessed he must be as tired as she was, covering so much distance as fast as they did, but after a while, she started to suspect that it was more about her than the exertion. One morning, close to a week after their panicked flight from the hilltop, she waited as he cleared a low building that used to be something to do with washing clothes on a massive scale. She tried to speak to him when he emerged back into the pre-dawn to go and set his snares.
"What was this place?"
she asked. "What does it matter?" he shot back, making her recoil in surprise at his tone.
"I was just—"
she tried before he huffed and stalked off. She watched him go, her lips tightening into a thin line to stop her calling out after him in anger. She went inside and found a comfortable corner to rest her shotgun and slip her pack off. Her annoyance at Cole was still pretty raw, which took away her excitement at seeing new things, but finding huge bins of folded linen gave her at least some purpose as she set about creating a comfortable bed to sleep in for the day. She carried two more folded stacks of the off-white sheets to where she'd made her bed and contemplated making one for Cole, but stopped herself, dumping the stacks down roughly to invite a plume of choking dust to puff back up from the surface to her face. Coughing and stepping away, she set about finding anything wooden to break up and start a fire to boil water and cook the two rabbits they'd carried with them through the night from their last resting place. They kept one each in their packs, wrapped inside a cloth to prevent them leaking bodily fluids onto their gear, and she pulled out her small knife to begin the practiced task of skinning it as soon as she'd lit the fire. After her third failed attempt, she began to shave more small slivers of wood from the leg of an old chair until she had a small pile on the concrete floor before her. She used the flint and steel that fit into the handle of her other, larger knife to strike the metal together until the small shower of orange sparks began to blacken and smolder in the pile of shavings. Bending to move her hair aside and blow off the tiny embers, she sat upright and cursed when the flame disappeared to nothing.
"You need something else," Cole said from behind her. He held up a hand and backed up a pace, wearing a face full of apology.
He reached into a pocket and pulled out a small handful of white fluff that looked like raw wool.
"Found it stuck on some scraps of what used to be a fence," he explained. "It's dry. Should work."
She nodded her thanks to him, reaching out to take it, but not speaking, as she didn't trust her voice after the scare she'd suffered. She pulled it open to let the air get through the small fibers and struck flint to steel once more. She was rewarded instantly by a tiny skein of smoke as the dry substance caught the spark and turned it into a tiny flame. She fanned it with her breath again, picking it up to cup it in her hands until a small flash of fire danced upward and wobbled in the artificial breeze, putting it down to begin adding the slices of dry wood until the ball of wool was consumed by the flame and the wood gave off the familiar smell. She leaned back, moving carefully, as she knew such a young fire was a fickle and delicate thing that could so easily fade away with just one wrong move. She placed the smaller of the broken sticks around the flames in a kind of inverted cone, starting with three equal-sized pieces resting on one another as the others were rested against the delicate frame. The wood began to crackle and snap as it caught, and already a small amount of heat was radiating from it. Satisfied with herself, she looked up to see Cole hadn't moved in case he disrupted the careful operation.
"I'll get some more wood," he said, holding his pack and guns stoically as he turned away.
"Did I do something wrong?" she asked.
"No," he said. "Not today."
"Today?"
she asked, one eyebrow inviting him to dig himself deeper into a hole.
"I can't do everything for two of us," he said quietly, half turning to speak to her. "It's good that you started the fire today, so thanks."
"I'm not pulling my weight," she asked acidly. "I'm not doing enough."
Cole rounded on her with a face of annoyed honesty.
"You're not used to this, are you? Living like this, always moving."
"No, but—"
she answered, not knowing what she was going to say.
"I am," he said.
I've been doing it for a long time, and a lot of that time has been spent on my own. I'm not used to, he waved his free hand at her vaguely, people.
Then tell me what you need me to do, Lena said with an edge of pleading in her tone. Help me learn. Teach me. And maybe this won't be so miserable.
Miserable?
Yeah,
she shot back.
Don't you want to enjoy any part of your life?
Cole mumbled hesitantly.
Exactly. Now go and get some more wood so I can cook up some rabbit.
The next couple of days went by smoothly. They talked softly as they walked, sharing experiences and stories about things. The malice and resentment subsided. They talked about the aliens and their drones, about how Cole had escaped from them more times than he could count because they thought like machines and not people. She used the weak light of their early evening journey to show him different plants and what they could be used for. They never spoke about the people they used to know. That much was still too painful for Lena, at least. When night fell properly and they had little to do other than cover as much distance as possible when the terrain allowed, they lapsed into silence, stopping every couple of hours for a short break. When they'd started their journey, she had complained and asked to stay resting for longer. Cole had told her that if she sat still for longer, her muscles would stiffen and she wouldn't be able to get moving again without suffering pain. She believed him, adding her own knowledge as a healer to lend his assumptions some support. He taught her how and where to set snares, depending on what kind of animals were thriving in the area they chose to spend their days. But that was mostly rabbit and wild turkey, which both made fine meals and gave them the much-needed protein their bodies hungrily consumed. She found herself getting leaner with each passing day, leaner but also stronger, in spite of being permanently tired. Twice they had seen their limping shadow when the clouds broke and the moon illuminated the long slice of overgrown hard surface they walked along. Cole told her how it had been called a highway back in the before, and seeing the coyotes still following their trail made both offer guesses as to why. I don't think it wants to hurt us, he said. Otherwise it would have made a move in the dark by now.
Unless it doesn't have the strength yet,
she suggested, but she didn't believe it. She'd begun to think of the animal as a pet, a friend. If it didn't have the strength, then it wouldn't be able to follow us, Cole had told her, sure of the answer. He seemed to think that it had attached itself to them for some unfathomable reason, and that thought made Lena feel something she hadn't felt in a long time. Happy. Likely the animal only followed them for food, and she didn't blame it. As the gray light of dawn broke to their right, the sprawling expanse of what had once been a city came into view ahead of them. They paused on the high ground that offered them a vantage point and stared. Cole stared, telling her he had nothing but bad memories about cities, and Lena stared because she'd never before seen such a wonder of human engineering. She knew that people had lived in great metropolises all over the world, but she had never seen so many buildings of such size in any one place. She turned her gaze of amazement on Cole to see a darkness furrowing his brow.
What is it?
She asked, worried.
It's a choice, he told her darkly. Do we go through it or around it?
How much longer will it take to go around?
She asked.
A couple more days, he answered. But it'll be safer.
With a resigned sigh of missed opportunity, Lena agreed to the detour. 26. Dex. Whatever the obvious choice was for two runaway roamers, he didn't feel like that was where these particular ones were destined for. After finding the hideout in the house, Dex's world had expanded. Patricia Bond was no goat. She was the real deal if she had access to a terrorist-safe zone like that one. She was well-armed and had sustenance. Where did this Alec fit into things? He needed some answers,
and staying ahead of the other hunters was going to be imperative. Tubbs was already on their trail, and he'd ventured west a little ahead of Dex, and he hadn't seen a sign of the other hunters since yesterday. Dex had cruised down the highway toward Chicago the previous evening and decided to camp out and listen to the chatter over the network. He pulled out the tablet as he sat in his car on the side of the road and scrolled through countless messages from the various guilds. So far, only their region was being called into this job, so that was a good thing. If the neighboring hunter guilds had been notified to cross borders, there was no way these two roamers would last out the week. As he sat in the dark, chain-smoking stale cigarettes, he thought of something. He remembered Cleveland explaining a new feature on his tablet, one that allowed them some insight into the Seeker's data streams. It was a tool created to give the hunters a leg up. They could stream video footage from the Seekers and any other geographical information that might prove useful.
"How the hell do I access it?"
he asked himself as his fingers attempted every folder on the tablet he could find. Frustrated, he tossed it to the passenger seat and grabbed his pack of smokes, only to find it empty.
"Empty," he said, remembering something.
Cleveland had told him it was a backdoor access patch and the folder seemed empty. He snatched the tablet, found the appropriate icon, and tapped it. There it was, the Seeker data file. He scanned through it looking for any sign of news on the roamers, but there were over 7,000 Seekers in the country. The number was staggering, considering he didn't feel like he encountered them very often. He changed the search parameters and selected the active drones within 100 miles of Detroit. The number dropped to 300 drones. At least 10% of them were decommissioned or being repaired. This still left a lot of information, so he started by accessing those within 50 miles of his current position. It was going to be one hell of a night. He checked the clock and found it was almost 4 in the morning. God, his eyes hurt, and his vision was getting blurry. He needed some sleep. As he was about to recline his seat, lights flickered from the west. It had to be coming from the lower edge of Lake Michigan. It was at least 20 miles from his current position, and it clicked. There was a big distribution center there. If he was a terrorist, wouldn't he strike them in the heart of their operations? What better way than by destroying food or a supply chain? It was a long shot, but Dex thought he might be onto something. His windows were rolled down, and he raced toward the light. The overseer's ship rose in the dark night sky, a beacon of terror as its clunky body was propelled forward with loud and angry thrusters. His steering wheel shook as the vessel lifted into the air before racing away. If his gut was right, the two roamers very well might be at the warehouse now. He kept driving, trying to not wonder why two of the huge occupation ships had been airborne in the last few days.
Alec. The man didn't stand a chance. Monet rolled over and jabbed her knife into the man's chest, directly into his heart. She pulled him under the trailer with them, ramming her hand over his mouth to keep him from shouting out. His eyes danced wildly, and he met Alec's stare. There was the flutter of a struggle before the life drained from the guard. Alec's breaths pushed out of his lungs in quick succession.
"We have to hide this,"
she said, her voice steady. She was already dragging the body to the rear of the trailer. The doors were fastened, but not pressed fully against the number 2 bay door. Alec didn't hesitate. He climbed the back and tried to swing the door open.
"The latch,"
Monet said, and he fumbled with it before finding a way to open it. The metal handle landed with a clang, and he cringed. Monet was trying to lift the dead body up by the shoulders, and Alec grabbed hold of the corpse, assisting her while Monet now pushed on the boots. Together they slid the guard into the empty space, and Alec hoped no one would notice the blood smears on the outside of the trailer until they were long gone. He glanced at his own hands and saw they were streaked with the dead man's blood. He fought the revulsion he felt and wiped them fruitlessly on his pants. He shut the door, trying to move in silence. The latch vibrated and clinked as the bright light of the spaceship rose from the other end of the warehouse's lot. The overseers were there. At that moment, there might be hundreds of them, and Alex had just watched his new friend kill a man without so much as a blink of the eye.
"There's no time to waste. We have to get into number 12.
Monet pointed to the parking lot where dozens of guards and workers were watching the big ship rise into the sky. They were distracted. Now was their shot. Alec and Monet ran to the front of the trucks and tried not to appear out of place. Everyone's eyes would be half blinded from the brilliance. Even if they looked at the pair of them, in the darkness they would appear like nothing more than silhouettes. When the coast was clear, Monet picked up her pace, and Alec followed until they came to truck 12. There was a driver standing at the front, sipping a beverage and staring at the sky. They slipped by undetected and made for the rear of the truck. The trailer was unmarked, with the exception of the number 12 stenciled on the side and rear. The bay door was open, and as he neared the opening, he heard voices carry from inside. He peeked inside, only to see workers in jumpsuits, just like the ones he'd been forced to wear every day back in Detroit. They walked around slowly, heads hanging low, every one of them too skinny and malnourished. Was this what he'd looked like? Was this what had become of their people? In the last few days, everything had changed, and he didn't think he'd ever walk with that much sadness again. Monet lifted a finger in pause and plucked a tiny device from her pocket. She tucked it into the wheel arch of the trailer's rear tires and smiled to herself. He climbed up the back of the truck and found it nearly full of supplies. Skids of products, food, bedding, and clothing lined the trailer two rows the entire way down the expanse of the interior. He was thin enough to slide between them, and Monet was up there with him, pressing him forward. He felt the tension oozing off her as they squeezed to the front of the trailer. Alec glanced behind them as he heard a noise, and a young girl caught his eye. She held the door handle with her right hand and locked gazes with him. She looked scared, afraid to say something, and terrified of not speaking up. Alec shook his head slowly at her. It was a desperate, pleading look, and she seemed to comprehend his plight. Monet turned her attention to the girl, and Alec noticed her lips quiver before the door closed, leaving them in darkness.
"Is she?"
Monet started, and Alec shushed her.
"Everything good with 12? A muffled voice carried through the shut and latched door.
"Locked and loaded,"
the girl replied, and Alec breathed a sigh of relief. The truck's engine sputtered, and he felt the shake as the driver put it into gear.
"I can't believe we did it,"
Monet whispered, pulling him close. She smelled like sweat, a sweet, musky scent, not unpleasant. Alec only wished he was a little fresher. He wasn't going to make good company in a confined space. She didn't seem to notice or care.
"I thought you had something called confidence?"
he asked, unable to hide the laugh, nervously setting aside the fact that she'd just killed someone.
"Sure, but that can only take you so far. I think we're going to be able to make it to McCook. If we get these details to the reclaimers, we might be able to stop the overseers from the next step."
She kept moving in the dark truck, and he stood there, watching her, afraid to ask her what that next step would be. He was already too deep, and knowing things were going to become far worse before they might improve was only going to shatter his current mental state. He left the question to hang dry in his mouth as he joined her at the front of the trailer, far from the door. Back here, the skids were marked for Denver, and Alec let himself dream that they would indeed make it to McCook unscathed. 27. Dex. The commotion of the overseer vessel departing had ended by the time Dex reached the security check gate. A handful of semi-trucks passed the other direction, and he nodded at one of the drivers before the guard stepped up to his window, hand on his belt. God, Dex hated these pretend police officers. They didn't know their butts from their faces, and every single one of them was a cocky jerk. He knew the type. Hell, he'd almost been one before the incursion. They were always bullies. Guys who thought they could get friends by being tough, beating up the nerds, and intimidating anyone else. Now they had all gathered and formed a new club, which meant they worked for the overseers, carried guns, and wore terrible blue uniforms.
A hunter? What are you doing here, Mr. Hunter? Run out of toilet paper?
The man asked with a laugh that implied he'd told the world's funniest joke.
Sure, kid, whatever gets me through this gate sooner.
Dex knew he didn't really answer to the punks, but he had to play by the rules.
I don't like your attitude,
Dex cut him off.
Listen, kid, I've been up for 2 days. I killed 3 roamers and still have their blood on my jacket, and I really need to use the bathroom, so if you wouldn't mind letting me in while the blood's still fresh, that would be fantastic.
The guard glanced at Dex's black leather jacket, as if searching for signs of splatter.
Sure thing, sir.
The bar went up and Dex drove through, wishing the guy had given him a little resistance. Just once he wanted to punch one of those guards. The warehouse was immense and he could see at least 10 trucks loading up goods. Trent James wasn't kidding when he said supply chain and logistics was still a huge part of the world. He'd known about this kind of place, but hadn't given it a lot of thought before. Now his mind was reeling as he drove up to the parking lot. He'd contacted Cleveland through his tablet, and his boss told him to meet with a woman named Krista. She'd be able to help him with the footage.
You better be barking up the right tree, fella,
he told himself as he parked, rolling up his window and locking his doors. He didn't trust these guards to leave his stuff alone. Dawn was close, and he saw the first hints of another day. Birds were already tweeting in the trees out front, and Dex trudged along, hoping Krista had a fresh cup of brew going. He needed the kick. The entrance to the building had 2 guards who scanned his ID without comment, motioning him inside, where he was forced to give up his Glock as he walked through a detector. Surprisingly, they handed it back to him as he entered the foyer and looked up at the 30-foot ceilings. This was the kind of place the high-up humans might work. Trent James had been a supply chain wizard, and even he had to answer to other people. The man threw it all away because his conscience had overpowered him, and Dex hated that the seed of doubt was now planted in his own head. A couple of weeks ago, he would have sauntered in here with all the arrogance in the world. Now he didn't know his place in this world and wasn't sure he wanted to. There was a desk where a doughy man sat staring at a tablet.
I'm here to see Krista, surveillance, he said.
The man nodded, his jowls shaking with the movement. There was no way this guy was on a strict diet of gruel like the average worker.
I've notified her you're here, mister.
It's Dex, just Dex.
The man didn't appear to care, and he stayed silent. Dex paced the floor, finding a water dispenser where he filled a little disposable cup and drank 3 of them, before crumpling it and tossing it into a trash can. Being around so many people was always a strange feeling. There would be a few of the aliens around, there always were, but now that he thought about it, the fact that humans were doing all the overseer's dirty work without being held at gunpoint constantly blew his mind.
Dex?
A voice asked, and he turned to see a stunning brunette in a jumpsuit. She was dressed like the rest of the workers, and he found it off-putting. He struggled to find his voice. It wasn't often he'd been lost for words.
That's me. Sorry. Not used to having real conversations,
he said, glad to have finally replied.
Krista, I gather?
I gather? Who was he pretending to be? He suddenly felt self-conscious. His hair was out of control. His jacket probably did have blood on it, and he hadn't brushed his teeth in a few days.
Right this way. Your Hunter Guild captain contacted me and said you needed to view some footage of our facility for an urgent roamer alert?
She asked with enough tact to keep her voice to a minimum as they passed a couple of other people. She led him along a corridor and into a compact room with 10 screens. There was an older man half asleep at his desk.
Tony, you can take a break, thank you,
she said with a smile, and the man vacated the room without so much as a glance at Dex.
"What are you looking for, exactly?"
she asked. He thought about the seeker data and how hard it was to access the right details. He needed to pinpoint it. If the roamers were here, they'd have to be on camera.
"Can you tell me how many entry points there are to this building?" he asked, avoiding looking directly at her.
"There's the main doors, and that's the sole entryway, with the exception of the bay doors," she said.
"There are no guards at the bay doors?" he asked.
"There are, but not in the same way as you encountered when you arrived. They're mobile, watching everything,"
her answer came quickly.
"What if there was a distraction, like, I don't know, one of the alien ships rising into the air?"
She didn't reply. He was onto something, he knew it. If they arrived at the warehouse, that would have been the perfect disturbance.
"I guess the guard's attention might have been on other events at that time. What would you like to see?"
she asked.
"Can you show me all the feeds you have of the bay doors?"